Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. Let's have a look at the front pages before we meet our panel. The Sunday Times is leading with child patients wrongly put on waiting lists. This is an internal investigation at Children's Health Ireland. And there's some absolutely extraordinary stuff, and we'll come back to it in a minute. The Business Post is leading with exclusive Google chief commits to Ireland as Trump threat grows. So tech boss tells Business Post that EU needs to cut red tape or risks losing AI investment. So it will not have escaped your notice that all the multinationals are using the current situation to kind of apply a bit of leverage on the government and on the EU on various fronts. The Sunday Independent, 4 weeks to try to save Europe from all-out trade war, fears that pension funds could fall by 20% in doomsday scenario. The Irish Mail on Sunday are talking to the Frankie and Theresa McCann, and they are, you will remember, their 19-year-old daughter Kia died alongside her best friend Dilava Mohammed, who was 16, while they were being driven at speed by Anthony McGinn from Clonus to Monaghan in July 2023 on the way to their Debs. So Frankie and Theresa say that Anthony McGinn has never apologised to them, and they dispute his barrister's claim in court that he has expressed significant remorse, but they feel he has not apologised to them. And The Sun and The Sunday World are both leading with, as The Sun says, the man quizzed in the murder case of Kerry farmer Michael Gain has been on the streets of Tralee in the last few days with his flute, out busking, I think. So the man has identified himself. He is former US trooper Michael Kelly. He has repeatedly denied any involvement in the death, but out busking, he said it's a matter of public record. He was being treated as a suspect. So this is the man who lived and worked for 3 years on Michael Gaines' farm in Kenmare. OK, our panel this morning, Mick Clifford is special correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Bridget Laffin is Emeritus Professor at the European University Institute. Peter Brown is Managing Director of Bagot Investment Partners. And Suzanne Rogers is a Research and Policy Analyst at Social Justice Ireland. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Mick Clifford, will you just take us through, and we have time here, this story, it's on the front page of the Sunday Times, but John Mooney has a big piece inside detailing a catalogue of dysfunction at Children's Hospital Ireland.
Yeah, they're saying, Brendan, it's a Children's Hospital Ireland, or Children's Health Ireland Hospital, but they're not saying which one. This emerges from a report, I think it was compiled in 2021, and it shows a whole litany of issues that arose there. For example, one involved, they're suggesting that a consultant devised schemes to enrich himself. And this involved a consultant referring patients whom he was seeing in the public system to his weekend private practice against the rules under the National Treatment Purchase Funds.
So just to be clear on that, he had his own waiting list.
Yeah.
And it actually says in it that these people could have been seen quicker if he handed them over to some of his colleagues' waiting lists. But instead of that, he referred them to his own private clinic at the weekend.
Exactly. And which is against the rules specifically to do that, apart from the fact that quite obviously it's not in the best interests of the patient.
They would have been seen quicker in the
exactly,
public system.
Yeah. That's one example. There are others. The we said that about the consultant referring that. The other issue that arises, there's so-called, there's elements of bullying, they're saying, within this unit in the hospital. One trainee recalled being made the scapegoat for clinical outcomes over which they had no control, all the while being undermined publicly by their supervising consultant. In another incident, a consultant allegedly encouraged a parent to lodge a formal complaint against a junior over an issue in which that junior had no involvement. There are talks about professional rivalries in there as well. And There was one instance there, we mentioned one consultant. There was one clinic in which 179 children were seen in the clinic. 95% of them could have been handled earlier. This is back to what you were talking earlier about. Could have been done earlier. Professional rivalries, all that sort of thing.
These huge kind of egos at play here, clearly. And there's an example where there's some kind of investigation going on, and everybody refuses to speak to each other about what went on.
Yeah, that's right. It was a review that was organised to establish what was happening. The team refused to even speak to one another, choosing instead to litigate patient care decisions through back-channel correspondence. Now, the other element to all this was compiled, it was certainly dating originally from 2021. It is unclear whether it was referred to the medical council and the newspaper, the John Mooney, they contacted the Department of Health, who had no information on it at all. So you'd have to immediately wonder, this quite serious, extremely serious report was compiled. What happened as a result of it?
Yeah. And we'll just make clear to people that this is in no way connected to the story of hip surgeries that's been out over the last week. Suzanne, you were looking at this as well. It's absolutely extraordinary, isn't it?
That's probably the only word you can say on air to describe what we're reading about. Like, it really is extraordinary. And it's certain lines really struck me. So there's one here again on the front page of the Times. Patients were picked for reasons unrelated to clinical urgency or waiting time. It says here possibly because their appointments were not complicated. There's a part of my brain that goes, I wonder were they parents that they thought, well, we know that they can pay for this. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah. You know, if you're going to pull out particular families and particular parents to say, well, actually, I have a funny feeling they might be able to cough up the 200. Now, that's being very cynical, of which I will put the hand up for that.
Yeah, but there is another example where one colleague refuses to do a particular procedure because he said that's not my speciality, and he palms it off on someone else. But in the following days he did two similar procedures with someone else. So yeah, you'd wonder.
You would worry, and I think this is the thing. And even like, there's a headline in one of the papers here to do with a bank, and it talks about a culture of fear, and that's actually one of the threads that's come through a lot of the stories this morning, is a culture of fear in the workplace, the inability. Or the you are unable to call out your boss, you're unable to call out your peers, you are unable to turn around and say, hang on a second, what's actually happening here? So that is a real concern. I think the toxicity, working in a place where you probably do know something is going wrong, but you're too busy trying to maintain your own job, you're trying not to get into too much trouble with your peer groups. That is quite extraordinary. I just think that the staff seem to be unable to, as you said, talk to each other and call out, because this behaviour was happening. Somebody somewhere knew.
So, Bridget, you know a bit about governance and things like that. Does it seem here as if this medical workplaces can be extremely, we're not going to get into any specifics about anyone or anything here. Medical workplaces can be particularly hierarchical with some people. There can be demigod kind of situations in these situations, and a situation where junior staff are really just treated as that junior staff.
I think it, from what we've read, and it was based on a report from 2021, the only conclusion to draw is that Children's Health Ireland is a sick governance system. It's sick. There is no other way of reading what we're reading here. And it all comes down to who's in charge, who's running clinical governance, where are the checks and balances. And we live in an era of big data. So you can have databases of all the procedures, all the hospitals, and it should throw up if there are anomalies, if there are strange movements and whatever. So no one is guarding this. I mean, for me, it is...
Have consultants had too much power in the health system traditionally?
So I'm not a specialist on governance in the health system, but this is a sick governance system. And of course, the hierarchical element matters. Consultants tend to be almost sole traders within a public institution, and that's very dangerous. But you also must have, with clinical governance, you must have someone in charge of the overall clinical governance, who's in charge of the protocols, who's in charge of making sure the protocols are implemented. If they're not implemented, who does something about it? But it shouldn't require... We're bringing in medics from outside Ireland to do these reports all the time. We're calling on medics from other countries to come in. Our system should be sufficiently robust that the you will always have problems, but our system should be sufficiently robust that problems are picked up quickly and addressed. This is really, really serious. And it involves, I think, Children Health Ireland involves a number of hospitals. And it's not...
Yeah, and we won't get into
that. And we won't get into
that.
Which
one it is or anything else. But look,
this is deep.
And we have seen in other situations, we're not drawing any analogies between them, but we have seen other situations where a lack of peer review, multidisciplinary teams, oversight on various things was absent.
And part the recent one on the overuse of hip surgery, it was based on a protective disclosure. It was only outed by someone who was very concerned within the system.
Yeah,
but it required someone to have a protected disclosure rather than the normal processes picking it up.
Okay.
So we should be really
worried. So the whole system should be in place for this, but actually it took one brave person.
One quick thing about the hip surgeons. I mean, the outstanding thing about that story is the differences. Now, if there was a scenario whereby culturally you had a system in there that consultants across the board were they were having surgeries done when they weren't required, there's a possibility there that, you know, it could be down to a medical thing, it could be down to interpretation. The difference that in one hospital, 79% of them were unnecessary, and in another, just one out of 63, which is about, 2% or something. Just inexplicable. It's not something across the board. It seems to be dependent on individuals and how they conduct themselves. Yeah. And that's back
and
to the hierarchy.
I thought it was interesting. The Minister for Health was very clear on the news the other night that the person who did the report into the hip surgeries was an eminent international specialist. He was offered lots of reasons by lots of people as to why this had happened. And he didn't accept any of them, she said. He accepted none of their reasoning. I do want to say, before I'll come to you now, Peter, Children's Health Ireland are quoted in this piece saying a number of underlying concerns, service gaps and issues were identified in the, quotes, named service, so it's redacted where it was, which needed to be explored and understood in greater detail to ensure supportive action and corrective measures could be put in place where required. The internal review report was presented and discussed at board. The recommendations were accepted, implemented and continue to be implemented. So that's the spokeswoman for CHI. Peter Brown.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a bigger picture here, right? And this HSE organisation is structured in a fashion, right, that the motivation within it is to hold on to what you've got, your biggest piece of the empire, your biggest piece. Don't let anyone take anything. So there's this internal competition all the time of not to let go. Don't let go of my budget. Don't let go of this and this. Then on top of that, there is no accountability.
This is a problem that's across business in general. Fiefdoms, is that what you're talking about?
This is the problem with the HSE and why we've never been able to properly restructure it in 30 years, right? We've never been able to because there's people in there going, not my area, right? And then you've got a situation where there's no accountability for poor performance. You can't sack anyone. There's no accountability for poor performance. So that kind of an organisation is going to be very inefficient. At every level, we get it in the UK. It's not an Irish thing. It's just a thing in terms of if you've got situations where people can't be disciplined or removed for poor performance, you get this sort of thing.
Yeah, I'm sure the HSE would say that there is accountability for poor performance.
There is,
and
right.
You can't sack people.
So the HSE should be structured on, it's a customer-focused business. That means the patient. You get paid by curing and looking after patients. That's not the way the thing is structured. On top of that then...
Well, hang on. I think part of the problem here was that these people were being paid per patient
the consultants were getting extra money.
Yeah.
But then you've got a situation where I think that the consultants have the same sort of power that priests had 30 years ago. You can't question them, right? They've got that sort of... Look, you can't call them out. Because... When you see what Mick said there, right, that the process and procedures were there. There must have been plenty of people down the line who knew that these surgeries were not making the standard that they needed to be done. But they weren't called.
Well, we don't know how many people knew, but one person anyway.
Well, there's an awful lot of people in a team.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. There's been an awful lot of people in an operating theatre.
Yeah.
Right?
And again, this has been identified in similar situations in the past where there were people uneasy with what was going on in these situations, yeah, but didn't feel they could speak out. Okay. On a related note, Suzanne, the Mail on Sunday today, Paul McAuliffe TD, is writing, parents need quicker public access to professional assessment of their children, which is, you know, I mean, kind of stating the bleeding obvious in a way. But this has been back in the news this week, mainly as a result of young Cara Darmody. Fair play to her. So what did you make of this?
I suppose it picks up on Peter's point about the balance of power. So if a consultant says to me, your child needs X, Y and Z, I'm obviously going to go, yeah, sure, you're the professional, this is your arena. But this piece is really picking up on the fact that what you know about your child and how you know in your gut, my child needs something, I need extra help for my child, I need provision for my child, but I need to get this official diagnosis. And what I thought was interesting about this, again, it's about staffing, it's about, you know, that the fact here that a lot of the staff are busy doing assessments and not doing the therapy.
Some of the assessments taking up to 90 hours, yeah, which seems extraordinary. Yeah. Like, that's two and a bit weeks of, yeah, of somebody's work time, like, to do an assessment.
You know, and I would have thought, again, you know, I suppose my immediate thing is, this is not my area of expertise, but I would have thought that it should be quicker. But when they're talking about staffing levels, I'm thinking we're now back to a conversation about housing. A friend of mine has just been going through cancer treatment. She was getting radiotherapy in Beaumont. Her nurse commuted in from Armagh to Beaumont Hospital, right? So it's all very well to say
that's not uncommon.
You know, this is it. You know what I mean? So you're kind of going, it's all very well to say we're going to put in place more therapists. We're going to put in, you know, we're recruiting professionals, all of that. My child's school puts up on Facebook probably every summer saying, lads, we're recruiting new teachers. Anybody got a spare room for them to live in?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's a much bigger issue.
It's all interlinked. Yeah. Like, Mick, the assessments of needs story, you'd swear it had only come up like in the last few months. Like, I mean, I remember when I woke up to this world myself 15 years ago being absolutely stunned at, yeah, the numbers of it.
I've been writing about it for 6 or 7 years. Brendan, I originally came across it through a friend, but I've been writing about it at length of time. Look, the first situation is, it's highly unusual legislation for a timeline to be brought in anything. It was brought in specifically in this Disability Act on the basis that without urgent attention being given to these conditions, they're going to digress, so therefore it had to be within 6 months. That came in the Disability Act. That was a very positive thing. It was seen as being a very advanced thing at the time. First of all, the disability services have always been underfunded. They've always been the poor relation of the health services. Secondly, there has definitely been an increase in incidences of issues like autism. There's absolutely no question about that. Thirdly, we also have a culture whereby, I was surprised during the week where I think I heard Norma Foley saying there are over 30% of people who go for the assessment of needs ultimately don't need, yeah, services. So do we have a culture whereby, as you said, a parent has an instinct that something is wrong, but is that superimposed now? Do people think that there
may be... You see, I wonder if that 30%, though, a lot of them could be parents who recognise their child is struggling in some kind of way,
yeah,
and that, but in order to access any extra help, they have to go through that system.
Absolutely.
Instead of there being a system there that picks up a kid who's struggling or diverging in different ways.
That's very true. And the other thing in relation to it is, remember, this doesn't even include anybody in that scenario who find themselves on this waiting list. They're going to go private. So anybody who can afford,
yeah,
will go private. And you're talking about people who can't afford, and it gets much longer.
But the other thing is, like, the assessment of needs is all very well, like, but even when you get it, there's no services,
yeah,
there anyway. So look, yeah. Suzanne, you want to come back
and on that assessment, that, you know, again, talking to parents, that if to get your diagnosis you have to maybe hit, say, 8 out of 12 markers or something like that, and their kid is maybe picking up 6.5, 7, that's your 30%. Do you know what I mean? So you're right, not, yeah, yeah. You are going in with concerns. You are going
yeah,
in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's exactly that. So I think
there's one other element to it, though, and that is like the HSE tried there a few years ago to narrow down the definition of the assessment of needs, and it was only in the High Court, and people have continually had to go to court to assert their rights in this. It was only when the High Court came back and said, no, that will not do. And that's why you have the longer waiting okay. list now with people who had been initially put through that.
But it's, okay. It's not unrelated to the previous story around the governance in the clinical system. It's we don't seem to be able to put together services in place that are accessible to people with the level of effectiveness that is required for a growing population. And we have forever had a problem with how we bring public policy to bear in area where people live. And it's yeah. systemic. I lived in the Netherlands for 1 year. My daughter was having funny fits. It's called funny fits in children. There was a village. I lived in a village. There was a health service in the local village. I was told bring her there. I brought her there. We were sent within a week to a hospital. She was given a little card. And we had her tested the following week. And I was told, go home. No need to worry. If I had been in Ireland, I would have struggled.
Yeah.
For years, probably.
Yeah. And you know what? In fairness to a lot of the people who work in those organisations, I think they would all say as well that they are spending more time on bureaucracy and paperwork than they are on actually seeing children. That seems to be a growing.
This was the 90s. And there was no paper in the hospital I went to in the 1990s.
Yeah. Okay. Now, to World Affairs, Peter. Niamh Horan and Senna Maloney writing in the front of the Sunday Independent today. 4 weeks to save Europe. It's like a tagline for a film. To save Europe from all-out trade war. So can I ask you first, is anyone taking this seriously? Like the markets were off, I know, with the S&P 1% in America. It's not the dive that we saw previous Trump.
Is about the boy who cried wolf. Right, it's getting to that stage with Donald Trump. You know, 50% tariffs, okay, I won't do that. 10%, no, I won't do that. It's getting to that stage. If, however, we ever got to a situation where there was 50% tariffs on European goods, then we would have a stock market crash of 2008 proportions. There's no question about that. It would be catastrophic, right? So nobody in the financial markets believes that that's actually going to happen. It'll get rolled back. So I'm not even going there in terms of it actually believing it's happening.
Okay.
I'm rowing it back, right? But what is happening here is all of this, I'm putting 50% tariffs, I'm not, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. He is seriously eroding the reputation of the United States financially, globally. Really eroding it. Really dangerously eroding it. And as you say, there's every chief executive of every company across the world is looking at, will I do business with America? Do I need to diversify? Will I make that investment decision? And that's happening in Ireland. Investment decisions are getting stalled. And that, if it keeps going, will lead to a global recession. Not a financial crash, but a global recession.
So the uncertainty is
terrible. It's absolutely terrible. Now, there is huge problem in America. And this is the debt maturity wall. Their interest rates are rising. They have $6 trillion worth of debt to finance in June alone. In June alone. Who's going to buy it? That's their huge question. And we're running into this situation. And that could cause a lot of turmoil in the financial markets. And it could cause a downgrade of U.S. debt.
Did I see that his new tax bill actually caused more ripples really last week than all the tariff stuff?
Yeah, so his new tax bill, which runs to 1,116 pages, is going to increase U.S. debt by $4 trillion over a decade. Right, over a decade. So $400 billion a year. Hits the poorest people worst. Right, it hits the poorest people worse. But the really concerning thing here for people in the finance sector is the absolute, like, I have no clients invested in America. Out completely. Right? None. Right? We're in Europe, we're in Japan, we're in our emerging markets, gold, silver, things that are solid quality assets, right, that will survive any sort of turmoil.
So you've nobody invested in any
in the S&P 500.
An ETF S&P, or anything?
No S&P 500. I've got people with ETFs that are quoted on the New York Stock Exchange, but they're not of the S&P 500.
Yeah.
So the real problem with America here is the debt.
There's a panic now going on. People want to read their pension company and say, I want to get out of America.
No, but that's very hard.
Swiss francs and gold, apparently, are the new safe haven.
No, so, well, gold's been brilliant. I mean, gold's doing really, really well and should continue to do so. And it's a great diversifier.
But I presume most Irish pensions, if people have them, most people's pension fund is with some big kind of company. I presume America has a certain weighting in that as its standard.
So the 60-40 pension that 80% of people will have is S&P 500, 60% of S&P 500 and 40% of Western European bonds, which has been great for all of the last 10 years since the crash. It's been fantastic. S&P up 350%. It's been a brilliant place to be, right? I would seriously argue it's absolutely the wrong place to be now. Right.
Okay, America's tanking is what you're saying.
I just think America is becoming seriously
unbearable. And we'll take that to your opinion, obviously.
Yeah.
Bridget, I suppose the question that arises here as well is Europe fit, agile for these kind of negotiations? Because it does sound like, you know, Trump's a bit of wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. And as long as you give him kind of something that he can sell back home or whatever, Europe is this line by line consulting with everybody. There's, you know, there's layers and layers of bureaucracy there. Are they able for this kind of stuff?
Trump is Europe's worst nightmare. Without a doubt. And they are in negotiation. The Europeans have offered zero tariffs for zero tariffs. A fair exchange. We won't tariff you if you don't tariff us. Their demands are at the upper end. They're demanding, they think they're more powerful than they are. So they're almost using coercive statecraft against the Europeans. So what's going to happen is the Europeans won't get, you know, jump up and down and get too excited. They'll continue the negotiation. And that's the only thing you can do with Trump. I don't think we'll see 50%. Not a hope. But you could see Europe having to deal with, I mean, the so-called Liberation Day tariffs were 20%. That would be a serious barrier to trade, and the Europeans would retaliate. They'd have to. You can't buckle under to a bully. But on the other hand, and I think the Europeans are also very worried about any ripple effect on European financial markets from the US. So they're being cautious, and I think they're right to be cautious. They will just have to keep negotiating, and that's the only thing to do. Those who are negotiating on Europe's behalf, Sabine Vehan, the head of DG Trade, she's an outstanding trade person. She really is outstanding. Šeškević, we know him well, Brexit. So I think the European team is strong. It's calm. The Europeans can't jump up and down
Is it that America wants them to jump up and down? Scott Bissent said, look, the idea of this 50%
to
is
light
to light
a fire
under Europe. Do they need a fire lit under them?
No, because the Americans are now looking at European VAT and all of that, which has nothing to do with tariffs. So the Americans are being, they're a disruptive power now. Yeah. They're not a cooperative power.
Do you see a landing ground somewhere?
There most certainly is a landing
ground. But not a good one.
No, there could even be a good one. But what there won't be is a landing ground as long as the Americans continue to ask. Their asks are above what the Europeans could ever deliver. And even though the Americans have a quasi-deal with the Chinese at the moment, it's again only for 90 days, which reinforces uncertainty again. So I would hope that the adults around, particularly Bessin, the adults around Trump will pull this back. And the other thing I would say is that I think it won't involve pharma, because they're doing a report on pharma that's due in December.
Right.
So I think anything on pharma is likely to be the end of the year. But the trouble with Trump is he's so capricious that we'd be very foolish. You're an astrologer if you think you know what he's going to do next.
Yes, and we promise not to play back anything anyone says here, even in a week's time, okay? Suzanne, you wanted to come in there briefly before I take a break.
To pick up on Peter's point, like when you look at the Silk Road, you know, and the fact that it was tolls on the Silk Road, that was your major trading route, and people went, nah, not having this, we're going to find a way to sail around this. So I think you are right, we're going to start looking at different ways, different places to put our money. But just to pick up on this, it was the million, billion, trillion bit, a million seconds is 11 days. A billion seconds is 31 years. A trillion seconds is 31,688 years. Just to put some perspective on those numbers, because I think, you know, I never thought you'd lose sight of what a million, a billion, and a trillion are. But they are exponentially huge numbers.
If you just look, the S&P 500 has no growth in it this year at all. And the dollar's down 10%. So if you're in that, you're down 10%.
Okay.
European stocks are up 10% this year.
Actually, briefly before we leave this, Lucinda Creighton has a piece you picked, and it's got some kind of ray of hope. Fresh deal with UK will strengthen Europe overall and amid global trade chaos. She's kind of saying we need to get over what she calls the Brexit sulk.
So,
and that is, it's going to be easier now to reinvigorate trade with our closest neighbour.
I think the Brexit sulk is over. I think it's a very good thing. It was a deal that was good, is good both for the EU and the UK. It has a defence and security partnership, which is clearly needed in present climate. For Northern Ireland, the SPS, the phytosanitary agreement that they will reach, will take a lot of the anger and the neuralgic sentiment out of the border in the Irish Sea. The link to the electricity markets is good news, and the link between the British, the emissions trading system. It was at the upper end of what could be achieved, given that the British won't go into the single market or the customs union. But it is a very good deal. And the other, of course, was the fact that they agreed that nothing changes on fish to 2038, because fish was going to become an annual battle. It's gone. So I would say in a pretty bleak world, this was good
news.
Bit
of good news there. OK, we'll take a break. Mick Clifford, Bridget Laffin, Peter Brown and Suzanne Rogers staying with us. Welcome back. Our panel are still with us. Mick Clifford, Bridget Laffin, Peter Brown and Suzanne Rogers. And I'm just going to read this text in fairness, because it is fair. Why would anyone become a doctor or a consultant? Do we ever hear of all the good they do? My husband had an accident recently. He got such good care from the trauma unit for plastic surgery in CUH. And that's from Mary. And Mary, you're so right. Obviously, they do terrific work. We're focusing on a particular aspect of things there. You know, sometimes we're talking about one strand of something, but of course, the other 90% of the people doing good work are not included in that. Listen, Suzanne, there was a kind of a very Irish row about holiday homes in Mayo this week. Maria Cahill is writing about it in the Sunday Indo. People with holiday homes did not cause the crisis in housing.
I mean, that's literally all you need to read of that piece. It's just the headline. There you go. But at that, as you said, you know, it is extraordinary that you know, somebody has called out for a boycott against holiday homes.
This is Tom Gilligan of Mayo County Council.
And
he did subsequently recant and apologise for anybody.
He did.
He stuck his guns for a day or two.
I mean, you know, he's quoted here in the Mail as saying that he believes the key issue is not ownership itself, but how we manage housing availability. But they are almost the same thing. If you own private property, who gets to say what you do with it? And again, a lot of the language around this is about...
So I'm not getting where you're standing on the holiday homes bit of it then, like...
Do I have to declare?
No, you don't need
bias
to declare anything. But, okay.
As somebody who goes to Mayo and rents somebody else's holiday home on the regular basis, that's where my mother's from. We go down as much as we can. But like the homes that we see as holiday homes are owned by locals. So it tended to be your bachelor uncle, never married. He passed away. You inherited a house. Nobody wants to live there.
Maria Cahill points out that they have a holiday home. Family in the middle of nowhere.
Wouldn't
be suitable for someone to live in
the
winter.
It is a balancing act between the fact that a lot of rural Ireland is reliant on tourism. Again, she makes that point that they're down, they're in the pub, they're in the shop, they're doing their bits and pieces, they're going to maybe a pool in the local hotel, that type of thing. So it goes back to a conversation about housing. So if the argument is that there are vacant homes that should be put to use for people who live locally, then why aren't there public or social homes for people to live locally? So it's again, it's about that piece about, you know, what we build houses for, who's allowed to own a home, what they're allowed to do with it. So he's here that he owns two rental properties, and his argument is
So this is Tom Gilligan, who it has emerged in the Mail today, Mick. owns, well, three houses.
Yeah. He owns three houses, his family home and his two rental properties. And according to the Mail, according to the market as it currently stands, he could, if he's so minded, at market rates, get 5,000 a month for his two properties. And his argument, as Suzanne said, is that it's how you use the properties as much as anything. But I mean,
just to give him his due here, he's saying that his focus is on providing homes to people, permanent housing that's accessible and secure. So he's not renting them out on the holiday home market or the short term market or anything else. He owns two rental properties. We do want.
Oh, absolutely.
People renting out houses. Listen, people.
From South Kerry, as Bridget is, and the tourism industry in a place like there is vital, and you need available.
What's the feeling in places like that about the holiday homes, people? There seems to be a certain, would you call it a kind of a pretendy fondness and a tolerance of
well,
people?
I look, I
they treat them like their own when they come into the local.
I have to declare an interest in that I frequently use a relative's holiday home in the same area, so maybe I'd have a biased opinion. But there's no question. There are huge tracts right up the western seaboard of empty houses. This notion that they're empty for 50 weeks of the year, I think, is exaggerated, but they're empty for a large space of the year. But then, you know, to me, this whole issue that he rose is nearly like a cry in the wilderness. I don't think this one makes sense. But what he seems to be saying on one level is drastic action needs to be taken. I don't think this is the drastic action. But because we are not taking any other drastic action, you're going to have suggestions like this being thrown out there all the time. And it's back again to the same old thing. We say there's an emergency. The powers that be do not behave as if there's an emergency. A lot of that is down to the fact that homeowners will lose out in some way if there's any kind of an emergency declared, and the balance of power lies with homeowners, and therefore they won't.
Are homeowners really that bothered at this stage about the price? If you're living in your house, about it going down?
It's a good question. I wonder.
I don't know. Has recent research not shown that a lot of people would actually be okay with it because now their sons and daughters are having problems?
I suppose it would depend on where in the cycle of repayments and loans they are in that, Brendan. Are some going to think that they get into negative equity, particularly people who purchase
early
more
recently?
Yeah,
situation.
Exactly.
Yeah,
you know?
And
as well, like we don't even have proper property taxes in this country. And similarly, the likes of inheritance tax, which is largely a tax on the ballooning housing market. Last budget, we actually raised the threshold. So you can have €1 million houses that are a result, inheritance taxes due on them, and zero taxes paid in them. And most of that money is down to a housing market rather than anything that was paid for the houses.
Okay. Peter, there's an interesting point that Mick makes there is that as long as we have this problem, people are going to throw up ideas. Some of them will be daft, but we were always taught that brainstorming should be a non-judgmental environment, and maybe we shouldn't slap people down if they throw out something crazy. Like we need to throw out ideas, don't we?
Well, I've thrown out some crazy ideas on this show and passed on the housing situation.
Yeah.
And my view of the housing situation is still very simple. Once we keep talking about 30,000 to 40,000 houses a year, you don't get the sort of decisions that are made. If you start talking about...
Well, I think we're talking about 40 now and increasing over...
No, but we need 100. Now, when you get to 100, now you can throw all the other stuff out and you go, wow, how do we solve building 100? Right? 100,000 houses a year.
But we can't solve building 30,
yes, you can.
Like.
Yes, no, but you can solve building 100. Right? Because we built 100 back in the day when we didn't need them. Right? So it can be done. And it was done with foreign labour. I see here.
The front page of the business Michael Hayes you picked out, Killian Woods. We can't build developers' cause for radical tax cuts and rent control.
It's tax. It's tax. Right. I mean, Michael Hayes, the CEO of Avira, which is the biggest private home builder, says
all those private home builders are making healthy profits every year in the double digits. Like
exactly. So, unfortunately, if you want to solve the housing crisis, you have to provide an amnesty, and you have to provide an amnesty. People own land, people develop, people build. You've got to provide an amnesty to make it seriously worth their while. Right. If you want to build the 100,000 or the 500,000,
what do you mean?
I mean a tax amnesty. Cut the VAT off. Cut the VAT on profits on building. If builders don't have to pay tax, banks will lend them money to develop. If building houses become seriously profitable, you'll get foreign builders.
It is seriously profitable.
No, it's not. For most builders, it's not very seriously
profitable. Apartments might not be, but like...
No,
like
but most, for most
all
builders,
the big home
not.
Builders in Ireland, I see their profits, I've reported all the time, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19%, which isn't a bad return on your investment.
Yeah, but you don't have it so profitable that... foreign builders go, let's go to Ireland for 5 years. There's money to be made there. Let's bring all our resources with us and build tens and 20s and 30,000 houses in Ireland. Now, you need to put sort the planning and all the issues and the services as well. But you need a COVID type, let's build 100,000 houses a year for 5 years, or else we're going to be sitting here
and you're
in 5 years'
time. And
you're
saying the pull factor in that is to make it super profitable.
Super profitable. Get it done.
Does anyone else agree with that?
Okay.
we're going to be sitting here in 5 years' time, building 30,000 houses a year, and the shortage is going to be 10 times worse, and the issue in Mayo is going to be 10 times worse, and the issue everyone else.
So what you're saying, as we saw around the table here, you're saying that things that are unpalatable to people need to be done in favour of an
outcome. We had tax amnesties in the past. We've had loads of tax amnesties in the past.
But it's the structural issues, Peter. I mean, you're talking about planning, you're talking about utilities,
water,
you're talking about CPO.
Electricity.
Exactly.
Water.
All the way through the housing commission, airport, water.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So those problems don't get solved tinkering around with 30,000 houses. If they've got to build 100,000, they've got to radically change the planning. They've got to radically put the infrastructure in place. They've got to make COVID-type decisions
to get it. Law.
And you won't get... Yep, absolutely. You've got to change. You've got to do all of that sort of stuff to get it done.
Do we not...
At this stage...
Do we not get into all that looser regulation before, and did it not end up in a whole period of building where the things that were built weren't fit for purpose? And
yeah,
and
so you need to... Exactly.
Finance situation crashed the whole country.
So you put in the resource to make sure that the building regs are adhered to. You put in those rules. That's the government's job to look. The water, the planning, the thing. The government sort that out, right? But create environment where there's an absolute massive appetite to build houses.
To sort that out, Peter, you don't need to have a...
But you need non-profit housing, because this is ultimately the difficulty, is that, as you said, I will only build 100 houses if I can make a profit. If I build 100,000 houses, the law of supply and economics 101, the law of supply and demand should state that the price of that house should drop, which is what we say we want. But if a builder won't build, if the price of houses is going to drop, he's going to stop building.
If you turn around to builders and say you don't have to pay tax, have to pay tax on the houses, we'll get rid of the VAT, right, the house prices, and we balance up the demand supply issue that we've got in this country, the price of houses come down, rental comes down. Why not then say,
I don't need to pay tax. Let's scrap income tax and let everybody put their money back into the system that way.
It's absolutely not fair. It's absolutely not fair. Neither was the dirt crisis, where we gave people an amnesty to kind of, you know, a dirt, and we had a VAT amnesty on businesses before. That was never fair.
Yeah.
That was never fair. I'm not saying it's going to be fair.
Actually, I'm saying, I've learned.
So, absolutely. So,
Bridget,
I'm saying,
you wanted to get
do
in
you
there.
Want the houses or not?
Yeah. So, okay.
Peter's suggestion is radical private, that you incentivize the private sector to deliver this. There are most European countries, the public system also supplies houses at quality within cost. So I think
the state as a developer.
The state as a developer. So
and then people,
I would not
and you know
advocate,
what people say then. They say, well, they tried to build a hospital. Like,
I would not advocate the state as the only developer, but the Irish state has actually built an awful lot of good housing in the past.
Yeah. Yes.
So I think it has to be a combination of both.
Do you think we need a housing czar, maybe?
we do, but we can't afford to pay him 400,000 plus. Well, we shouldn't pay him 400,000.
I'll do the job for that. That's no problem.
but there,
yeah. Just let Bridget finish.
What I think is what we can't accept as a society is we put our hands up and say it's hopeless.
Yeah.
And we can't do anything. This state has the capacity. The Irish political system has the capacity to do this. And I trek a lot, so I'm up in those mountains, looking down in Dublin. Space is not our problem in this country. Yeah. And the other thing we have to do is we've got to build up as well. We've got to actually...
Yeah, but then you see, you know what happens as well. Like, you know, everybody has an opinion and everybody has a right to block an issue
at the moment in terms of viability.
And look, I'll just say, in fairness to the government, they are pumping more money than ever, billions into housing. I also see that the Minister for Housing has written a letter, it's in one of the papers today, to the local councils, and he's saying to them, "I need you to. The new development plans, I think, are done." And basically, he needs them to ramp up their numbers and ramp up their targets and start looking at things. So look, you know, they are. It's. I think we can sometimes give the impression they're doing nothing about it.
Oh no!
The trouble is, if money could solve it, it would have been solved.
Yeah. Okay. Who wants to tell me, Suzanne? David Quinn in the Sunday Independent today, lowering the voting age to 16, he says we'll push politics into classrooms.
Yeah, and he makes that sound like it's a bad thing. That's the bit I find quite extraordinary.
Well, I think his concern is that young people, as he said, like edgy things, and that they might be a bit far righty, like.
Or you know.
Or far lefty.
Far lefty. Yeah. Like, he has here the second reason.
I'm saying his concern, yeah.
Yeah. But that's it. I mean, I think it is. We were all young once, a long time ago. I mean, my own political awakening was the miners' strike, and you had a choice between Thatcher and, you know, so
Scargle.
Like.
Scargle.
Well, I mean, this is it, you know what I mean? But like that. I just think politics from a very young age, every single child in this country is very aware of this, because I think he's maybe confusing, putting words in his mouth, maybe party politics with politics in general. I do think every young person should be able to engage with the system, because ultimately the decisions that I make as a middle-aged woman are going to impact them much, much longer than they will on me.
He makes one good point. Who thinks 16-year-olds should be able to vote?
I do.
You do? Yeah, I Peter?
Think, why depress them?
Yeah.
Make. I'm two minds of it, to be honest with you.
Do you have a 16-year-old?
I do.
would you give him a vote?
My 16-year-old?
we're not applying IQ tests to voting yet, or sense tests to voting, I'm afraid.
He makes two points there, in fairness. One is that the population's getting older, so there's a case to be made that 16-year-olds should have the vote on the basis there's going to be far more power in the grey vote than there already is at the moment.
Yeah.
On the other hand, this talk, and Suzanne mentioned, he's talking about their interest. Reducing what he calls leftist activism, and he described, because there's a module on climate activism.
Yes.
Well, I would have thought climate activism is neither left nor right, it's just science, and that's something we should all be more aware of.
Okay, we have to take a break. I for one had no sense at 16. I shouldn't have got the vote till about 40. Mick Clifford, Bridget Laffin, Peter Brown and Suzanne Rogers staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel are still here. Mick Clifford, Bridget Laffin, Peter Brown and Suzanne Rogers. Suzanne, you picked a piece in the Sunday Times by Seth Franzman. In trying to fix its mistakes, Israel just digs itself deeper.
Again, I suppose it goes back to, I suppose, my fascination with language and the types of words that are being used. You know, there's bits in here about, you know, if we go back, you know, we go back to the beginning of this, he says, you know, 19 months ago, and you're kind of going, well, maybe we could go back maybe slightly further than that.
Yeah.
I was at the Trestle Fest last night in Liberty Hall, and they zoomed in the Palestinian activist and academic Omar Barghouti, because he wasn't allowed to travel out.
Right.
So he's telling what he sees, and that was really the story, was that you know, this is being live streamed, you know, we are all sitting at home watching this, but this particular piece,
the outrage is growing, though, you would have to say, and getting broader around the world, isn't it?
I think so, and I think it comes back to, because we seem to have spent a lot of our time justifying what we're about to say, so I genuinely think, regardless or irregardless of any bias or prejudice anybody may or may not hold, the deliberate starvation, it's not that people are starving, they are being starved. The deliberate starvation of a population has to be deemed wrong. The deliberate starvation of children has to be deemed unconscionable. I don't think I've said that right, but you know what I'm trying to say. And you know, these are children who've already been denied an education, they've already been denied healthcare. I mean, Trump is talking about, you know, American kids are going to have to suck it up and get $2 for Christmas. Like, these are children who have no experience of play, no experience, no carefree experience. I mean, we're watching them, teeny little tots, literally crowded in on top of each other with bowls out looking for food. I mean, that's not what any parent would want for their child at all. So I just think more and more people are having to say, this is wrong. What is happening is simply wrong. It cannot continue. It cannot be allowed to continue. It is wrong.
Why can no one stop this, Bridget?
Well, I think we saw one development this week that was important and very significant, and that was, for the first time ever, a majority of EU member states have insisted at the Foreign Affairs Council that the Israeli-EU trade agreement is looked at, because there's an Article 2 that the values are there in bold, and those values are being completely negated by what the Israelis are doing.
Is any of this going to do anything towards...
Oh, it will. The trouble is time. It's time. But Israel is in danger of becoming a pariah state. It is very dependent on trade with Europe. Dealing with Israel is a very complex issue for the Europeans, on the continent in particular, because of the guilt, not just for Germany, but all those countries that sent their Jewish populations to be gassed. But the fact that you now have a majority of countries in the EU saying this has to stop, I think emerges from the fact that the humanitarian crisis has reached such a level, and denying the food, the small number of aid trucks that are getting in. So I do think something is shifting. Of course, it's not shifting fast enough and effectively enough.
And does America need to be the shift ultimately?
Well, you see, I think the EU trade agreement is a very powerful instrument.
Is it?
It is a very powerful instrument.
Okay, well, we live in hope.
It's not as powerful as if the US stopped sending munitions. Yeah. But of course, there are European countries selling munitions. And Ireland, for example, it's the Irish Central Bank prepares the prospectus for Israeli bonds.
Yeah, so which they kind of say is a neutral act. Suzanne, just before we go, I did want to get to something that I know you picked out and you thought was an important kind of piece today. And it's in the Sunday Independent by Niamh Horan. And it's about the former broadcaster, or the current, she is a broadcaster, she's a former RTE broadcaster, Nikki Hayes. Mm. And it is just... a mind-blowing story.
It is a really mind-blowing story, but just to pick up on one tiny point from the last piece every time, but just
quickly,
you know, there was talk last night about, like, what do we do as individuals, what do we do?
Yeah.
And they were saying, like, every single act is moving us forward, so people can do whatever little bit you can do,
yeah,
you do.
Good, because people feel powerless. Yeah.
So, like,
okay.
Every brushstroke makes the bigger picture. But this is a story, I suppose, it is about addiction, it is about a lifelong addiction. It's like a somebody who's been struggling since they were in their early teens. But it's that story about, it's not happening to somebody over there, it's happening to somebody with a successful career from the outside of it, who looks to be really keeping everything together. And I suppose just how quickly a life can maybe unravel, and then all of a sudden you're on the radio one minute as a DJ, and then the next you're asleep in the hallway of Penny's, which is quite extraordinary. But again, really nice, she's gotten help, she's gotten the supports that she needs. But just in terms of homeless supports for people with addiction, it's really important that housing force piece is put into place across the board.
Yeah, and she you know, we tend to look at people on the street and think they're other or different to us or whatever.
Yeah.
And she was there, that person feeling invisible on the side of the road. And really, like, she tells her story extraordinarily powerfully and very bravely and everything, doesn't she? I think it'll really have a huge impact for a lot of people. Okay. That's all we have time for today. Jeez, lads, we could have gone on for another while there. But Mick Clifford, Bridget Laffin, Peter Brown and Suzanne Rogers, thank you very much for that terrific hour. I just let's give the last word to somebody from rural Mayo. I work here. I have a mortgage approval. I can't find a house to buy. I'd love to live in the middle of nowhere. Would live more urban if I found something. Loads of empty houses in my rural area. Nobody in them. 50 weeks a year. I'd take one in the morning if it was put in the market. I'm in my mid-30s now. So there you go. It's 12 noon and we'll go to the newsroom. And